Hello, beautiful. And what I want to know is what is really good in your life today? This is Kia with the season finale of the Female Veterans Podcast. Today, I have with me an incredible female veteran. She is an author. She's had 22 years in the military and she was in the army. And we're going to hear her story today, as part of the conclusion of the three-part limited series for the Military Officers Association of America, or MOA. And we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But first, I want to say welcome, Rebecca.
It is such a pleasure to be here with you today.
I am so happy you're here too. I can't wait to hear your story. So let's jump right into it. Tell me, what made you join the military?
It seems like it was a lifetime ago, back in the early 1990s. So I was growing up in a suburb of Detroit, Michigan. And we had an exchange student actually live with us for a year. She was Austrian. And we went abroad to visit her 2 years later. And it was my first time overseas and really getting to experience sort of the differences between the United States and other countries. And after that trip, I just felt very lucky and very fortunate to be an American. And then there was Desert Storm, which was pretty pivotal during my high school experience. So those two events sort of conspired, I guess, in a way to really open my mind to the possibility of joining the military. My parents were really excited. They hadn't been to college themselves. And so I went to a couple interest meetings in Michigan about the military academies. And so I applied and was really fortunate to be accepted to the United States Military Academy at West Point. And so that's how I ended up in the military. I did my 4 years there and then graduated. And then obviously spent a long time in uniform serving in the Army for 22 years.
Wow. So I totally can identify with some of the things you said. So when I was in private school at Milton Hershey School in Hershey, PA, shout out to my alma mater. In sixth grade, we had some Russian ballerinas come and stay with us. And we had these student homes where all the students lived, and they stayed with us. And they performed for, I would think it was our Founders Day celebration, and we'd always have sort of a symphony or some sort of culture on opera, something like that happen to celebrate this event of the day that the school was founded by Milton Hershey. And it happened to be these Russian ballerinas that were children that were our age, and they stayed with us. And even though we couldn't really communicate the same language, we found ways to communicate. And I remember when they left, we packed their luggage with our clothes. So we sent with them jeans, clothes, like shoes, everything. And they gave us those Russian stacking dolls. And that's what they gave us. So, but it was such a beautiful connection and such a beautiful bond. But I felt so fortunate because Russia was different back then. I believe it was still the Soviet Union. And they had so little. And I remember feeling in that moment how lucky it was for to be an American and to have been born here. And so I definitely understand and can feel that what you experienced and why that would make you want to serve your country, and be so proud to do so. So I want to know about West Point, though. Tell me, what was it like when you first entered West Point?
Yeah, it's sort of like prison, I joke. Yeah, it's definitely not for the faint at heart. Everybody goes through a similar experience in basic training, whatever service or branch of service that people join. But I think it was really, really difficult for me. I don't not uniquely difficult for me, right? Like it's difficult for everyone. But you go right from high school, graduate from high school, and 2 weeks later, they're cutting all your hair off and you're marching in a parade by the end of the day where they leave you there. But I didn't come from a military background. I didn't know anyone who had gone to West Point. And I really didn't know, I don't think, what I was getting myself in for on day one, nor day 350 either. But it was really, really hard for me. And I think part of it is just that sort of the people that you're supposed to look up to and those that are sort of the heroes in the eyes of those who go there are really are men, right? Who've mm-hmm. been, you know, these sort of heroes for 60, 80, 100 years. And what people really notice about you when you're at the military academy is your sort of physicality or your physical ability. And they don't really know your mental acuity or your other talents. And so I think for me, it was really difficult to demonstrate my value because I was a really sort of nerdy academic-y kind of person. And that's not readily obvious from just looking at someone, but it's really obvious if you're a slow runner or if you're not great at push-ups. And so, you know, those things were really difficult for me in the beginning. I was really fortunate that I was athletic though. And I played tennis my first year and I ended up playing lacrosse for the final 3 years. And I was the captain of the lacrosse team. And so for me, sports really bridged some of that gap. And I really was fortunate to have this sort of band of sisters on the lacrosse team and the tennis team in the beginning of my time there. As sort of this like wonderful group of women to lean on when things were hard, as they often are when you're a student at a military academy.
Were there a lot of other women there with you at West Point when you were going through?
There were not a lot of other women going through at the same time. Back then, it was about 10%. So I guess there was about 4,400 cadets. And so that means about 400 of us were women. I had about 90 women graduate from my graduating class. And so you also have this phenomenon where everybody thinks they know you because you stick out, right? You stick out because your hair is longer and you look a little different in uniform than men do. And so, you know, there's just this perception that everybody knows all the women there because there's so few of us, even though, you know, a lot of times people hadn't spoken to us or didn't really know us any more than, you know, just a person sort of walking by. So yeah, it was really, really hard for me. And I think in many ways, it was a great introduction to being in the Army and also being in the United States, which unfortunately is still a pretty misogynistic place. And so I think having those experiences early and, you know, a lot of the experiences are uniformly difficult for both men and women, although I think parts of it are definitely more difficult as a woman, or at least they were in my experience. But I think it prepares you well to deal with struggles and challenges that everyone faces in their life. So as much as I maybe didn't enjoy it when I was 18 to 22 years old, it's definitely served me well over the course of my life. And I do think the relationships that you build there with your friends, your company mates, your teammates, they really are lifelong friendships.
A lot like boot camp. So what I'm thinking is lots of physical preparedness and training, and then also the education piece. And what I'm understanding is that you were more keen in the education piece, although you played sports, which I do really love lacrosse, by the way. So that's pretty exciting. We have that in common. I did not play on a team. They didn't offer a team when I was going to school, but they did it part of the gym, like the physical fitness part. And it was my favorite. In fact, that and field hockey were the only sports that I actually enjoyed playing in school. And we played all of them as part of our curriculum. But I didn't love it. I also preferred the education and the academics as well. So tell me, you said that you had some difficulties with the physical portion until you played the sports and things like that. Was that really affecting you as far as morale goes when you were at West Point, and the fact that there were so many men? Did you have a lot of difficulties trying to overcome that?
So the physical part that was challenging for me is, you know, we had to take a certain number of physical education classes every year, sort of as you progress throughout your time there. And so just the classes themselves were things that I was particularly horrible at. So for example, there was an indoor obstacle course test that was part of, I think it at one point was a graduation requirement that you had to pass it. And it included climbing a rope and jumping up on this wall and a lot of things that I was just very, very bad at. And so I think early on, I just sort of gave up and just said, you know, I'll just fail. It's not a big deal. And then my senior year, I really decided like, I'm going to pass this thing. I spent a ton of time and effort practicing and practicing and practicing. And then on the day of the event, I still failed. So despite being, you know, an amazing athlete in many ways, I just still looked like a failure, not only in grade, but also just to, you know, everyone else who's watching you try to climb something and fall off. So it was definitely an exercise in humility for me. So in addition to that particular test, which obviously I was horrible at, we had gymnastics our freshman year, which also was not great at. Luckily by the end I had like squash and soccer, which I was actually very good at, but I think it was a good reminder that, you know, nobody is really great at everything. And so, you know, a lot of humble pie over the course of those 4 years. Because as you said, you know, you can be really great at a particular sport and still not do great in some of these like very strange events. Mm-hmm. So I think even more frustrating, you know, having really tried my best and still falling short.
I think a lot of people experience that in boot camp too. For me, it was boot camp, obviously. And definitely, I saw a lot of guys. I mean, it's an interesting dynamic because for me, we were a 900 company, which was an integrated company. It was one of the first ones. I think I was like the third or fourth one that they ever had. And so our company was half guys and half girls. And we did everything together. So having the guys watch you if you weren't particularly good at something, for me, I was absolutely terrified to jump off the 20-foot diving board. For in the Navy, you have to jump. And it's like the simulation of jumping off the ship, right? Abandoning ship, and you have to swim. And I'm a pretty strong swimmer, but I was so terrified of that jump that even when I did it, I panicked when I was swimming, right? So, and everyone's watching you. And so there's this bit of, like you said, humble pie of going, I might be really good at this. I might be really strong at the academics, and I might even do okay at the running, but there are certain aspects of the physical preparedness that I struggle at. And even watching some of the guys too. And I think it was the same for them, because as women, we kind of think, oh, the guys are watching and there's so many more of them than mm-hmm. there are of us, right? But, and we have to, there's this feeling that you have to be as good as them, or if not better, as well, I think, for women who serve in the military. And but also I remember watching some of the guys, and they were like obviously athletes in high school and your football stars or whatever, and seeing them struggle at some of the things, or seeing them really struggle at the academics. So I do definitely feel what you're saying about humility, and I think it happens to all of us at different stages. But it's interesting that for you it was West Point, and for me it was basic. It was standard basic training, but a very similar experience. And so that was when you leave West Point. Do you have to go, because I know a lot of officers go to field training, did you have to do that as well, or was West Point sort of your whole training to be an officer?
It was my whole training to be an officer, although in the summers there is field training there as well. So, mm-hmm. and then once you graduate, you chose the particular branch of service, and I was an engineer. And so everybody goes to their officer basic course from mm-hmm. there. And then you meet, you know, all the other people from ROTC or OCS who are also of your particular branch.
So you said you made a lot of really close connections in West Point. And you keep in touch with them today, still to this day?
Yeah, I do. I would say my closest friends, one was my roommate. I had the same roommate for the last 2 years, and she's still in my life. And then we, the lacrosse girls were probably my other closest friends, and not just in my particular graduating class, but also some that were younger than me. And so I'm definitely still in touch with them as well.
I love that. That's so amazing. And so, what was officer school like for you?
It was wonderful. It was so different from the West Point experience that I just so enjoyed it. And it was there was still military parts of it, and we did, physical training together. But it really felt like everybody was in it together, and there was a lot of teamwork. And I made a lot of great friends actually at the basic course there, maybe more so than even at West Point. I had a really positive experience, and it was at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri, which, I don't think I ever would have chosen to live in Missouri. But we had such a wonderful time there, which seems so strange, but I really liked it. I liked my time there. And then, eventually you go back there again as a captain and for the career course. And both of my stints at Fort Leonard Wood, Missouri were wonderful, actually. That's where I ended up dating and getting engaged to my now husband.
Oh, that's lovely. So tell me then, after you finished officer school and you're ready to take command, take the lead, where did you go? How did your career be officially begin?
So my first unit was in Fort Lewis, Washington State, and I was in the 864th Engineer Battalion, which I was really excited about. So at the time, I think there were only seven combat heavy battalions in the Army, which combat heavy back then meant that it did construction. So my battalion had vertical and horizontal construction. So I was really excited about being in that unit. And I spent 3 years at Fort Lewis. My first platoon, I was actually in the motor pool. We had back in the late 90s, there was an excess of us, I think, and then we sort of drew down a little bit. But my first deployment actually was from Fort Lewis, Washington, and we went to Thailand, where I lived in a village and built a daycare center adjacent to a school, and I worked with the Thai Army. And I worked with some Navy Seabees that were reservists. And I had my own cook and radio operator and medic. And it was just this amazing opportunity for someone who was like 22, 23 years old to oversee this really cool construction project, like in the middle of nowhere. So it was awesome. And I had several other of those kinds of experiences doing construction in my first 3 years in the Army. And so I just really loved it. And that was kind of a mantra of my whole Army career was just, having these crazy opportunities that you sort of look back now and I'm like, I can't believe they let me do that. It was just awesome.
I can imagine being 23 years old and building a daycare and just getting to go to different places around the world and build things. In the Navy, you would have been a
Yeah,
Seabee.
exactly.
And everybody loves the Seabees. This is the coolest, cool, one of the coolest jobs. So, how was it like when you would land in these places? What was the civilian population like? How did they treat you?
Yeah, in Thailand, they were really warm and welcoming. And we actually built a pretty strong relationship with the Thai army that was sort of in our sector. And so we would have barbecues together. I'm trying to think of what else, like some just parties that they were really excited that we were there. It was a part of a larger exercise, Cobra Gold, went on for decades, I think. And there was all sorts of different kinds of units would come and train or work with their Thai army counterparts. And so actually building something was clearly in the community's benefit. So it was something that everybody was really happy to have us there doing. And it was really our, go to war mission was construction. And so it was a really big win-win for all of us.
What was it like being in your sort of early mid-20s and being in charge?
Yeah, so I loved it, but it always comes with some challenges. I think, it's not dissimilar for every sort of new lieutenant when they take their platoon, is your platoon sergeant is inevitably, 10 to 15 to 20 years older than you. Your squad leaders are all like 5 or 10 years older than you. I mean, almost everybody's older than you, except like the privates, maybe, and the corporals in your unit. But you have to sort of own the things that you know and that you've been taught, and they're different things than your NCOs and your soldiers. And so I think for me, it was really empowering. I think I was worried maybe at West Point it was going to be really hard managing this sort of dichotomy. But it actually in practice wasn't difficult at all. I think in part, I had some good platoon sergeants who, you know, knew this is sort of the way it always goes. And we worked well together, and, you know, recognizing each other's strengths and relying on sort of each of our comparative advantages to, really have a strong platoon, strong platoon culture, and really, you know, trying to be positive at a time when it seemed pretty easy to do that.
That's fantastic, because I know that we had some, I think I had an ensign and I had a lieutenant. Now, I loved Lieutenant Baker. Obviously, we had the same last name. We'd always joke that we were sisters, but she was incredible. And I had another ensign with us. And in the beginning, it was really rough for him because we were the same age. So he must have been 20. And I remember he came in with a sort of chip on his shoulder, right? And everyone gave him a hard way to go. There was not a lot of respect initially. He sort of had to earn it. And then when he sort of calmed down a bit, and we all got to know him more, then, I mean, obviously I was always respectful to him, but I would hear the talk, right? And everything like that from everybody. And I'd see his behavior and I watched his behavior really shift and change. And he was actually really lovely. I liked him a lot. And, but he had to sort of calm down and integrate into we were all in the pharmacy. So into the pharmacy staff. And once he did that, then I think the dynamic changed for him, but I know he struggled in the beginning. Right, because people just didn't have a lot of respect for him because he was so young. He was obviously the lowest ranking officer, but he did come in with a kind of a big chip on his shoulder that he had to sort of overcome that. That made a lot of people go, we don't have respect for this guy. And I imagine that it can be really difficult for officers to come in and find their place with, you know, their subordinates. And really get the respect that they deserve when they're so young. Yeah. So did you ever have experiences where you had difficulties with people below you because you were so young?
I think maybe not so much because I was young, but I think my personality, I think it's easy for women to sort of fall into like a couple sort of archetypes. And so I'm a pretty friendly person and kind of bubbly and positive. And I think that can be seen as weak or I don't know the bad words for those things, but I think it gives people the impression that maybe you're going to just be able to be walked all over, or that you're not going to stand true to your principles, or that you won't defend yourself if, you know, someone disagrees with you. And so I think for me, it was more my personality and trying to regulate how I portrayed myself more than it was the age. And so I think there's just certain people that I think the way that women come across, it's hard to find the path to take between being like too mean and being labeled the B word and being too nice and being labeled easy. I think it's always a struggle to try to walk between those two extremes and find your way in a place that is comfortable for your personality and who you are, but recognizing that perception is often reality, in that people believe what they want about you based on how you act or portray yourself. And so I think that is something that women always have to be thinking about in all walks of life, not just certainly as an officer in the military.
Oh, I absolutely agree. I definitely am a happy-go-lucky sort of bubbly person too. So I totally understand where you're coming from, where people would have the misconception that you are a doormat or a people pleaser. And then sometimes when you are challenged and you have to show that side of yourself that you really aren't, you're just a nice person, but you're not to be messed with, then it can go into being labeled a bad girl or the B word, as you say, or that girl or something like that, within the space. And it can be difficult sometimes to sort of navigate that as women in a predominantly male environment. So sometimes you do have to overcome the labels or the perceptions of what people think. So I definitely identify with that, and I think that happens up and down the board. No matter what rank you are, no matter what your job is, I think that's pretty par for the course in all the branches. So
Absolutely.
tell me, what was your best experience in your 22 years?
Oh my gosh, there's so many great experiences. I think I'll probably pick two. So I'm trying to think what year it was. It was 2011 to 2012, I think. I was a strategic advisor in the Commander's Initiatives Group in ISAF, so in Afghanistan. So I worked directly for the four-star commander there. And this Commander's Initiative Group, which the nickname SIG, is a bunch of other weird people like me who were sort of picked for their particular skill set. And there was about 8 to 10 of us that worked directly for him. And it was like a mini sort of think tank. And it was just a really interesting group of people to come to work with every day. The work was amazing. My boss, the four-star general, was just someone that I thought the world of and very, very much respected. He was also like very thoughtful, sort of academic in his intelligence level, but also like a real sort of marine in every sense of the best way of that word. And so it was sort of the sweet spot of amazing coworkers, super interesting work, a mission that you really like felt strongly about, and really good about what we were doing. And I got to work on congressional testimony. I went to visit six different NATO partners where we were like with the head of state or, the highest levels of their military. So also just feeling like I can't believe I got to do this for work. I mean, it's just unbelievably humbling to be in this place. And so that was probably the most rewarding work. And it was at a moment in particular in Afghanistan, we're trying to draw down for the first time and really thinking about how are we going to pass off what the US and its NATO partners had been doing for many years. Was the Afghan government going to do it? Was an NGO going to do something? Was another civilian organization. So there's a lot of really interesting things happening at that moment. So it was just a really wonderful experience. And I'm still in touch with a lot of the people that I worked with then. I just respected them so much. And then my last job in the Army actually was at the State Department, where I worked in the Office of Peacekeeping, Sanctions, and Counterterrorism. So, as someone who had no UN experience, no Africa experience, I show up on the job, and like 30 days later, I'm in Somalia, like doing this big monitoring evaluation of the mission there, and actually like getting to put words in a resolution that, go to the UN and are, a mandate for implementation. I got to negotiate on the behalf of the United States, the contingent on equipment, like the reimbursement rates for equipment. So another just like amazing experience and opportunity. Got to go to several African countries. I went to the Middle East to see the peacekeeping missions there. So just both the responsibility I was given, the autonomy that I had, and my coworkers there as well were just like phenomenal humans. Again, I'm still in touch with many of them, but the work was so rewarding. And for me, this peacekeeping, I guess the peacekeeping world was something I didn't know anything about, and I just really fell in love with the idea of it, how it unfolds, the fact that it's more successful than it ever ought to be. And so I still teach a class actually at Georgetown on peacekeeping, as sort of all the things I wish I would have known on day one when I showed up in that office. And so the beautiful thing about life and serendipity is that, I taught the class a couple times, and I taught it to someone who then went and worked in the office where I worked And she's like, I knew everything I needed to do on day one because of the class. And so anytime you sort of have the opportunity to take what you've experienced and make meaning of it, like make life better for someone else, I just find it to be incredibly rewarding.
That sounds absolutely amazing. Okay. One of the best stories, I actually interviewed a public affairs officer from Canada for a series I did for the Veterans Channel a while back. And she had a very similar experience overseas and helping the communities and the work that she did. And I just find it so incredible when you get to go out into the community and do these kind of peacekeeping missions. And it seems that when you're a part of them, it's just amazing. It's amazing to be in with the locals, and everything to do with it seems to be so really cool. So I'm excited you got to do that. And now that you're teaching people and sort of continuing it into the world, I think it's so valuable and incredible. I have some questions though about Afghanistan.
Yeah.
When you first got there, what was it like for you? Because it must have been, I mean, you'd been around the world, I imagine, to different places already by then. But going there, what was it like when you first arrived?
So what was it like when I first arrived? So, I mean, I was on a compound 95% of the time. And so it looked not dissimilar to lots of other, you know, compounds where you or I have probably been, you know, in Kuwait or wherever. So I had a roommate who was, the first one was Canadian, the second one was Czech. It was really interesting. I think it was the first time I had been in a headquarters where there were people from all over the world. And just places like there was Mongolian soldiers. Like it was really interesting to see how many different contingents had troops serving in the headquarters. And you know, you basically got to work the next day. And my roommate always thought I worked shifts because I worked from like 6:30 in the morning until like midnight every night. And I was like, no, I don't work shifts. I just work all the time. but it was really interesting. Like I said, the work was really interesting. And all I saw most of the time was like the path from my room to my office and the dining facility and then back. So it was a pretty contained area of my life there for the most part that when I was there, other than the trips back, you know, the trips that we took together.
Did you get to go out into the local communities at all, or just it was work, no fun?
No, it was work. Other than, so, and we flew out of the Kabul airport quite a bit. So I saw the stretch of road between ISAF headquarters and Kabul International Airport, but that was about it.
So tell me, with all the work that you did there and how important it was to you, how did you feel when we exited from Afghanistan last year?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's really unfortunate how it all unfolded. But I think my experience there, I would just say that I think that was a likely conclusion no matter when we left. Mm-hmm. If we had left 5 years before that or 10 years after that. I mean, on paper, we trained hundreds of thousands of people. And yet, I don't know where they were, you know, the day that we pulled out. So I feel like it's unfortunate. And, you know, for a lot of people, they feel very personal about it. I don't. I think, you know, I feel really good about what I did while I was there. Do I think that, you know, in the end it was successful? Clearly not. I think every commander sort of did the best with what they were given, but I think we never really put the resources in from the get-go to transform it in the way that we acted like we wanted to turn it into. Mm-hmm. And so I don't know that it could have gone any other way, unfortunately. And that's just one person's opinion, and I could be completely wrong, but I was not surprised. And I think it could have been that end 5-10 years before or 10 or 20 years after we left.
Wow. Yeah, I can see your point of view. Definitely. Obviously, I didn't serve in Afghanistan, but I just find it incredibly interesting. And I think a lot of the veteran community was really triggered watching it all go down the way it did. It's almost been a year now, a couple months. And so I just think it's very interesting to have the perspective of someone who was there doing really good work there, with everything that happened. So thank you for sharing that. So tell me, what was one of your greatest challenges that you faced during your military career?
Oh my gosh. Greatest challenges. I think the most challenging job I had was my first job in Korea. So I was a battalion assistant S3, and I just had a really, really difficult boss. And I worked for him for, I want to say, about 6 months. And it was another one of these jobs that was like midnight or 1 o'clock in the morning almost every day. But it wasn't work that I thought was worth staying up until midnight or one to do, if that makes sense. So I think that was really, it was really hard. And my husband and I got married, and then we went to Korea, and he went to one place and I went to another. And so I think it was a combination of like the boss was really hard, the work was really hard, and just my personal life, it was hard, right? Like we didn't live together for 18 months almost. So it was, I think that was probably one of the most challenging jobs. But interestingly, like the job after that, I was a company commander in Korea actually, and the battalion commander that came after the first one was someone I just think the world of, who really took a chance on women in his unit in particular. So for the first time, he put a woman in charge of, or made her the executive officer of one of the line companies, which at the time was coded as a male-only job. And he thought she was the best lieutenant in the battalion, and so he put her there anyway. It was a really, he was a great boss, who really trusted his commanders, and I thought it was an incredibly rewarding environment to serve as a company commander under him. I had an amazing first sergeant, and the work was really great and interesting. I mean, our go-to-war mission was basically to do a lot of the earthwork and evacuation of folks from the DMZ, our battalions. And so, you know, you felt like what you were doing mattered, and that, you know, we knew what to do if something happened on the Korean Peninsula. So, and my boss let me be one of the external evaluators for another one of the line companies. So again, a line company that I was never going to be, or at the time was not allowed to be a woman. And he thought I was smart enough and talented enough and like knew enough to evaluate someone doing that job. And so many moments I remember just looking around, and I was the only woman of, I don't know, there was like hundreds and hundreds of guys. And I felt like I was prepared to be successful because my boss had prepared me to shine. So I feel like it's one thing to sort of drop a woman in a place and just hope for the best, and it's another to really kind of till the soil so you feel like you're set up to succeed. And I felt like he really did that for me.
I had a commander in the pharmacy that was like that. And I left one of the clinics because the new chief that had taken over from my beloved master chief, and it's like that in the military, right? So you have this amazing leadership, and then you might get someone else in that's not amazing. I mean, just call a spade, they might be misogynistic, racist, whatever it is, they're just not a good egg. And they get in this position of leadership, and then the morale just tanks, and everyone's miserable, and you just see it happen, right? And so for me, it was a great opportunity to switch into the pharmacy, and leave the branch medical clinic. And even though I loved what I was doing there at the clinic, I did not want to treat patients. So I switched into doing pharmacy work, into pharmaceuticals. And my commander, Commander Hirsch of the pharmacy, was the most incredible man. He was so amazing. That whole experience was like heaven. I loved it. I would have done it forever. I would have done it forever if I wasn't so determined that I was going to get out of the military after 5 years and go to college, because I went to the military to get education, get money for education. And my dream had been to go to university. So if I wasn't so determined that that's what I was going to do, and if I knew that I could have stayed with Commander Hirsch in that pharmacy, I would have done it. I loved that everyone I worked with, I loved everything about it. And so I definitely feel you when you have a great leader who sets you up for success. It just makes the entire experience amazing. And there were a lot of other things that were happening while I was in the military that weren't awesome, but I can tell you one thing for sure. That team that worked in the pharmacy was like heaven. Shout out to Melinda Scruggs. I did have to prove myself. The first 6 months was hard because I did an exchange with a girl that they loved and they thought they were getting trouble. Let's just say they thought my reputation, people's perception, my reputation preceded me. And let's just say it wasn't that great of a reputation for some reason. And when I got there, I worked my butt off. And in 6 months, everyone loved me there. In fact, I got a letter from the commanding officer when I left, a letter of appreciation and commendation. So for my work there for recruit surges. But I loved it. I loved it. So I definitely can vibe with great leadership, being set up for success, and really just having a great environment to work in. And when you have that in the military, that is such a gift, because from the conversations I have with a lot of women, they don't have that. And it can be hell, you know? So
it really can be. Yeah. The boss that's the opposite of that is unfortunate. It happens more often than it should.
Mm-hmm. It's so true. It's so true. I look at places like Fort Hood and I see all these headlines coming out of that place. And I'm like, what is going on in Fort Hood? And when is anybody going to do anything about it? Because you can see that the leadership there has to be questionable if all of these headlines are coming out and they're so derogatory. And I worry about the people who are stationed there because, you know, crazy things have happened there. I mean, we know the whole Vanessa Guillen story. As female veterans, it's really close to our hearts. Yeah. And there's, you know, so many other stories that are constantly coming out of there. And so, you know, it's just understanding that the leadership makes the difference. Like I said, it can be heaven or it can be hell, depending on what your leadership is like.
Absolutely.
So for sure. So tell me, did you happen to experience while you were serving any difficulties from being a woman who's a leader? Like, did you face any sort of misogyny or sort of insubordination based on the fact that you were a woman?
So I think the longer I stayed in, the less and less that being a woman was a detriment to my career. I think the lieutenant days and the captain days are the hardest, in part because that's just still a difficult age, I think, for everybody, but I think men in particular, until, you know, 25, 30, like, you know, the genetics of that, I guess. I think for me, it just got easier and easier the longer I served, maybe in part because you gain more and more confidence, the more opportunities you have to be a leader. I think, you know, once you've had both positive and negative experiences, you can recognize the signs before they get too bad, I think, mm-hmm. And really seek out, you know, mentorship or guidance or help when you can see some of these things coming your way. But I think so many times it can just be one person, right? Like the right boss at the right time or the wrong boss at the wrong time. And I think the wrong boss can really let the misogyny just sort of flourish. And I think, it's rare for a man to sort of point out like, this isn't, it's not okay to say this. And I think over time that's gotten better, but I think in particular, when, you know, your peers are other lieutenants or even a first lieutenant, I think it's hard. It's hard for anyone to sort of stand up to things they know shouldn't be said or done. But I think the more you're around, and the more experience you have, I think everyone gets better at countering that if they want to counter it. So most of the misogyny I felt was really much more at the lieutenant level. And I think in that command climate where my boss was such a proponent for competence, regardless of gender, and really was proud to put forth someone who was a woman, but the best, and the best, I shouldn't say, but... so yeah, I mean, I think it's rare not to experience that in the military, but I think it's rare to not experience it in any profession, to be frank.
That's a good point. I like how in the beginning of our conversation, you mentioned that the United States is still a pretty misogynistic place. And I would agree with that. I think we still have a long way to go as far as equality goes. I mean, I would say I'm a feminist who really, really loves men, but I definitely think that we need this equality, equal pay, you know, all of that stuff. And I think it's not just, and actually in the military, the pay is equal, right? But you have other things that you have to deal with. Whereas in the civilian world, it can be the pay and other things that you have to deal with as well. So I really love that you made that point. I'm wondering, what made you decide to leave the military and retire?
Yeah, so I was at a point in my career where I felt like I had done nearly everything I had ever wanted to do and then some. And I knew what the next 3 or 6 years were gonna look like if I stayed in. And I just decided that it was the right moment for me to exit. I've been selected to go to war college, and I just that and sort of seeing what was an what opportunities were next for me. I just decided that I wanted to try life as a civilian instead.
I definitely can understand. I mean, 22 years is a long time, and certainly earned it. So what was the transition like for you getting out of the military after all this? It's like your whole life.
Yeah. So it was really hard. It was definitely challenging for me. And I think it's so funny. So my husband's like, why is it so stressful for you? He's like, you can do anything. And I'm like, that's why it's so stressful. Because I could do anything, right? And I think it's just interesting, like how for him, that was like, that's amazing. And for me, that was like, that sounds awful. Like, how am I going to know what to do? What am I going to pick the right thing? Yeah. So I think initially, I really thought that compensation was the thing that was going to drive my decisions about where I landed. And in part, because for the previous sort of two jobs I had, you know, people who do good work get more work to do. And so I always felt like, this is my chance to finally be compensated for doing really good work. And so initially I was really focused on compensation. And so I had started to go down the path of the private sector, thinking about what I wanted to do. And we also knew we wanted to stay in DC. So obviously that was going to be a constraint in terms of the kinds of things that I was looking to do. So I did the MOAA route, and they had a lot of resources there. I did a couple different sort of transitioning military officer courses. The one actually that even the military puts on for senior leaders, for lieutenant colonels and above, I think CWs 3 and above, it was actually amazing. I really enjoyed the people that were taking the class with me. I thought the information was great, and I was feeling really like not ashamed, but really just sort of like disappointed in myself that I was so worried about what I was going to do. And, And it was really overwhelming. And then I remember talking to a guy in my class, in this transition class, and he was a colonel. He was, I think he had been a Marine, or maybe he was in the Army. And he had flown Marine One for like 3 years. He flew around President Obama.
Wow.
And this guy wanted to be a pilot. And he was freaking out. He's like, I don't know if I'm going to get a job. And I'm like, this guy knows exactly what he's going to do. And he's, I don't know, already done it. And he's freaking out. Like, it's okay that I'm freaking out, right?
Yeah, for sure.
So honestly, like, I think sometimes you just don't want to feel alone in your scaredness or in your uncertainty. Mm-hmm. And so just hearing someone else who clearly, like, he had his shit together, right? Like, he'd done a couple things before. Right. And he was freaking out. So I'm like, okay, it's going to be okay. I'm going to figure this out. And honestly, the number of people who are just wonderful and help you think about what you want, who are open to having coffee. I can't think of a person that I reached out to who didn't say yes. And so I do think it's always scary to put yourself out there and admit, like, I don't really know all the things, mm-hmm. but the only way you get help is when you ask. And so I really was grateful for, I had some classmates from West Point who had gotten out a couple of years before me and who were really encouraging. And so a lot of it was just sort of using my network. And this guy that I had spoken to, the Marine One pilot, he had a friend who worked at Amazon. And I was thinking, oh, maybe that's what I want to do. So this guy, so nice, connects me to his friend. He is at the fulfillment center in Delaware. And so I drive up there and he spends like the whole day with me, like showing me around Amazon, telling me what it's like. And this guy is telling me working at Amazon was more stressful than flying the president. And I was like, I don't know that this is for me then. And he's explaining, he's like, well, because when you order fill in the blank thing on Amazon, right? Like, mm-hmm. and you think it's going to be at your house tomorrow at 5, and then 27 people get the flu and the machine stops working. Like, you don't care. You want to know where your t-shirt is, right?
Right.
So he's like, I can't tell you how many times like some unforeseen event happened. And he's like, and I'm running around this warehouse. Like, where is the box of Kleenex? Right? Like, my hair's on fire. And so, I thought compensation was important and compensation was very good for him. But I knew that I did not want a job that had no flexibility. Mm-hmm. So pretty quickly I realized, okay, actually I want to know who my boss is going to be. I want to have a lot of autonomy. I want to have a lot of flexibility. And if I want all those things, it's probably not going to be a gajillion dollar job. And you know what? That's okay. And so after going down several paths, I ended up actually at Georgetown, which is where I am now. And I don't think I could have created a better job for myself. I couldn't have created a better boss to walk into working for after a 22-year, you know, stint in the Army. And I feel like it was the perfect place to land. And in fact, I basically was saying, like, I'm not going to work for another jerk again. Like, I'm just not doing that. And so I had applied for this job and they said, oh, there's going to be a new director. And I'm like, well, I want to meet this guy before I decide if I'm going to work for him or not. And literally, like, we sat down, he's like, Rebecca, I don't know a single thing about managing anybody. He's like, I want to learn from you. I want you to tell me, like, how do I do this and how do I do it well? And I'm like, this I can do. And like, that's literally how our relationship started. And like, it's just been a wonderful, wonderful 4 years, that we've been working together. So I just feel so lucky.
That's amazing. And that is lucky because I tell you, if the work environment is not good, then, and we spend most of our time working, life is pretty miserable. So I'm very happy that you landed in such a wonderful environment. I wanted to ask you about your experiences with the Military Officers Association of America, or MOA. You said that you had some resources from them. So what was your experience like with them?
Sure. So my experience with them actually predated my retirement. So I actually first joined MOA because they have this great supplemental insurance. So if you're a person who has a dependent and you're doing TRICARE standard and you end up using a lot of like the co-pays, basically we joined because they pay all the co-pays. So it was like this phenomenal insurance. And so when it came time to retire, obviously I looked at the resources that they have available. They do a lot of great transition courses for folks thinking about retiring or actually retiring. And I've now been one of the people that's been on the panel for those who are deciding to make their transition out of uniform into something else several times now. And it's just always a wonderful and really warm organization that has, military officers in their interests really at heart. I know they do a lot of important lobby work to make sure that our benefits stay, at least as good as they are now, or hopefully if not better. But the resources that they have on their website for those people retiring or even just transitioning are phenomenal. So I definitely recommend if you're a person who's considering retirement in the next couple of years, definitely check out their website.
So, I guess what I would like to know is what advice would you give for people who are considering using MOA, other than just checking out their website from based on your experiences with them?
So if you're checking them out, I would highly recommend you sign up for one of their webinars. I mean, they have everything from financial planning to, these sort of transitioning military officers courses where you can really talk to people from all walks of life who have, preceded you, who've done their time in uniform and are doing really interesting work. They're also a great connector of people. So even if you weren't able to go to one of their webinars or to one of the courses, I've had them reach out to me and say, oh, there's a person in Florida who is really thinking about an academic job and they're looking for advice. And so they have a really great network of folks who are eager to be helpful to you as you're thinking about your own professional journey. So I would just say they will meet you where you are. So whatever resource you're looking for, if it's not readily obvious on the website, then definitely reach out to them, connect to them, and I'm sure that they will find a way to help you.
And I love the organization. I've done a few of these interviews, and we talked about MOA with people who actually have used MOA. And what I love is exactly what you said. It's their ability to connect you with not only resources, but with people, because community is so important. When you're getting out of the military, it is such a stressful time. Like you said, you weren't sure what you were going to do. You were feeling like scared and unsure and kind of alone. And it made you feel so much better to connect with someone and know that they were having the same feeling. And what MOA does well, I think, is to be able to connect with you with people that can help you to wherever you are going in the world. I believe it was Kelly who said on my last MOA partnership interview for this limited series, she said that they connected her with someone where she was moving to in Texas, and they told her everything she needed to know about relocating there. So I think having this community is so important and can ease the sort of uncertainty and stress of the transition. And so it's really, I think, a beautiful organization. This is why I chose to partner with them. And as always, if you want more information about MOA on the Military Officers Association of America, go to www.moa.org. That's moaa.org/retirement-resources. And as you know, I will put that link in the description box of the episode. So just you'll read what this episode's about, scroll down, and you'll see all the links and resources there. So, Rebecca, I want to thank you so much for coming and being a part of the Female Veterans Podcast, especially for my season 7, finale, which is a special episode for me. And as part of this limited series with the Military Officers Association of America, I want to respect your time, but I just have a couple of more questions for you, if you don't mind.
Sure.
Great. I want to talk about your books. What made you decide to become an author?
Sure. So I did my PhD sort of in the middle of my Army career. Luckily, the Army chose me to go back and teach at West Point. So I had a couple years in grad school, and then I finished my dissertation while I was teaching there. So I turned that dissertation into a book. So it's called The U.S. Army and Nation Building, The Challenge of Nation Building, Implementing Effective Innovation in the U.S. Army from World War II to the Iraq War. So it's like a mouthful right there. So a lot of that interest really came from my own experiences in Iraq in particular, just really trying to understand, you know, at certain points in the Army's history, it actually innovated for nation building and then it never did so again. So what was so special about this moment sort of in the World War II timeframe? They had a constabulary force. They set up a school of military government. There were six different post-war plans starting all the way before we even entered the war. So it was sort of this anomaly of these amazing things happened never to happen again. So sort of memorializing that instance and then sort of contrasting it with the instances since then. I looked at Korea, Vietnam, and the Iraq War. It was just really interesting to me. And I was hoping would be interesting to others who may or may not find themselves in this situation again. So that was the longest thing I had ever written. And then most recently, I just did a book chapter in a book called Resourcing the National Security Enterprise, where I used my UN experience actually to write this chapter about how resourcing works at the UN, which is completely different than everywhere else. And it's sort of the book chapter that, I wish I would have had when I started my work at the State Department. So those are a couple of books that if you're interested in any of those things you can find even just on Amazon. So
amazing. Well, I will track them down and put the links in the description box of this episode for anyone who's interested. I think that's pretty amazing. I am really excited because I am putting together my first book, and it is a anthology. So I will write two chapters, and a bunch of my previous guests on the podcast are writing two chapters, and it's going to be an amazing, inspirational book to share with the world about what women experience while serving in the military, all different branches, all different ranks, and just really inspirational. So that should hopefully come out next year. I'm really excited about it, and hopefully we'll see it on Amazon with your books.
That's amazing. So many people will love to read that.
I'm really excited. I want people to be aware of what we experience, which is why I do this podcast and why I share amazing stories like yours with the world. And so with that, I want to ask you one final question, and that is, what advice would you have for your veteran sisters coming up behind you?
So my first piece of advice is don't be afraid to ask for help. I think too often we don't want to admit that we need help, and we don't want to reach out and bother anyone. We don't want to be seen as like one more thing to have to do for somebody else, given how much women take on themselves. But so I love nothing more than helping other women veterans in particular. And so I would just say there's no one is going to say no to you if you find them on LinkedIn or whatever social media you think works for you. Everyone is open to having, you know, a coffee to talk about their life and you know, what their experiences were. So don't be afraid to ask for help. And then the other thing that I tell particularly women who are sort of starting their career is choosing the right partner is one of the most important things that you will ever do. And I think the right partner can really amplify and support and encourage, and the wrong partner can do the opposite of that. And so many amazing women that I know have been impeded by their partner instead of really promoted and encouraged. And so I think more than any other decision in your life, you really need to think hard about who's standing next to you in that foxhole for the rest of your life. And so, you know, look to your friends, your family. If they don't love your choice, there's probably a reason, as hard as that is to hear. And so I would just really encourage you to think long and hard about who that person is and you know, are they really helping you be everything you can be?
Wow. I mean, that is some advice right there. And I wish someone would have given me that advice early in my life. So I hope that helps a lot of people, because that is so true. That is really, really true, especially the part of it, it helps or impedes what you're trying to do in your life and how far you're gonna go. It is so true. What we said about having stress in the workplace, the other thing is stress at home. So, and if you have stress in both places, that is a life of misery, and no one deserves that. We all deserve better than that. So, amazing, amazing advice. Thank you so much for sharing it. I appreciate you.
Well, thank you so much for inviting me to be on the podcast. It was really such a pleasure.
Oh my gosh, the honor is all mine. I want to thank you so, so very much for taking the time to share your story, as incredible as it is, and to share your insights and your experience. I know that, we never know how important our story is, but it could be someone else's survival guide. So there could be a girl who's headed to West Point who listens to this and learns so much from you. So I want to thank you so, so much for your time today and for sharing your story with me.
It's been my pleasure.
And if we want to follow you or catch up with you, how can we do that?
The best way to find me is just on LinkedIn, Rebecca Patterson.
Perfect. And I will put that in the show notes as well. Again, thank you so much for coming today. I really appreciate you. And with that, we're going to wrap it up. I want to thank you all for coming on this journey with me for supporting the Female Veterans Podcast. It's almost been 3 years. Can you believe it? And for listening to each episode. I want to thank you for your 5-star ratings on Apple Podcasts. It really helps the podcast grow and spread. So please continue to do that and share that information with your friends. And as well as you can follow me on Twitter at FemVetPodcast and on Instagram at the Female Veterans Podcast, and continue to listen and like and share this podcast with the people you know to keep us being, at the forefront of the female veterans podcasts that are out there. And there's a few of us, and they're all amazing. So, something for everyone. And again, thank you for listening. I love you guys, and I'll talk to you next time.